Welcome to the Math Ed Podcast. My name is Sam Otten from the University of Missouri, and today I am joined by Conrad Wolfram, who's the Strategic Director of Wolfram Group and CEO of Wolfram Research Europe, and he's written a book called The Maths Fix, an Education Blueprint for the AI Age. Conrad, thanks so much for speaking with me.
It's great to be here.
We're going to be talking about this book, and it's a book that is really resonating with me. I'm reading it right now, so I'm really excited to be able to kind of hear from you directly about the ideas in the book. And it's really kind of a large picture about where mathematics education is in the computer age, you know, in the modern age, and where it should be going. But before we get into the book, The Maths Fix, I want to just give you a chance to share a little bit about your background and what led you not to reading the book, but what do we need to know about you before you wrote this book? And people might recognize the name Wolfram, so how do you kind of connect into that name as well?
Sure. No, that's a great question. So with my brother, Stephen, for many years, we've worked on Wolfram Research, and that's a company that builds computational software. And you may be familiar with Mathematica and Wolfram Alpha. We've got the Wolfram language, and we were the inventors of the original notebooks to communicate math.
Wolfram Alpha helped me get through college and graduate school quite a bit.
Oh, that's great. And it's great to hear, you know, because I hear different generations now. I'm getting a bit older as I am. 50. So I hear different generations of folks who've, you know, used Mathematica and Wolfram Alpha, and it's actually really nice to hear that. So what we've really been doing since 1988 is trying to push the envelope of what computation can do using technology. And what's interesting about that is it started from very specific, you know, it'd be like, well, math is used in a few sort of specific places. Nowadays, it's everywhere. We've sort of interacted with that in the sense that we've both been a part of the, you know, the organizations and the software and technology that have pushed that to be able to happen. But we've also been, you know, riding along with that wave at the same time. So that's kind of the day job. And as I say, the sort of evening job is trying to fix up the human to make the most use of the technology. Now, so this seems a bit contradictory. It's like we're trying to build the most beautiful automated technology so you can use computation at the highest level without necessarily knowing all the details of how you do it on the inside. So you might say it's contrary. Why am I then saying we need to scale up the human to, in a sense, make the most use of this? And that's the evening job. And the reason is because people expect so much more out of what computation can deliver. So my evening job is to look at what's happened in education, particularly math education and the things based around it, and to really try and improve that. And the more I've looked at this, so to speak, the more discrepant the real world that I've seen in my day job and the educational world that I've been trying to fix up in my evening job look. And that's really how I've ended up getting into this business. And I should probably say before all of this, I studied physics and math at Cambridge University in England. So I'm sort of a physics-y math guy to start with, and that, you know, also do a lot of business side things as well.
Mm-hmm. So honing in on the education efforts, though, and your thoughts about education. So we have the book, The Maths Fix, an Education Blueprint for the AI Age. And so you're bringing perspectives from, you know, computers, from artificial intelligence technologies, and then you're bringing perspectives on, you know, what you're seeing in education. Just tell us a little bit about what motivated you to put these ideas in book form, and what were you kind of, what's the overall goal that you're trying to kind of achieve with this book?
For a long time, I gave a TED talk about 2010. And, you know, that kicked off a lot of things. In fact, this all started in 2009, really, with the release of Wolfram Alpha, because people started saying, you know, we can use Alpha in our math classes, as you did, right? And then they started saying, well, is it cheating to use it for your homework? Well, it's a great question. Depends what your homework is and what you're trying to achieve with it, right? So there's a sort of discrepancy there. So that got me thinking about this whole topic. So then I started developing more ideas. I thought about this actually a few years before Alpha came out, but that crystallized. And then I gave the TED talk. And since then, we've been building with computerbasedmath.org a lot of materials, curricula. We've been trying to figure out what does a new math look like. And, you know, I've given many, many talks. But in the end, the trouble is I give like a 20-minute talk and I try and cover as much as I can. But then people say, have you thought about this? And have you thought about this aspect and how you do this and how you do that? And it's like, yeah, we've thought about that. But it's like, I can't tell you in 20 minutes. And so I thought eventually, you know what, I've got to get this down so that people can see the whole proposal, the whole concept of what I'm talking about, all in one place. And that was really why I wanted to make a book. Now the thing I wanted to do with the book was, and what's made it tricky in particular, is I want it to appeal to quite a wide group. I want the sort of what I would call, you know, the the general public, obviously it's not gonna be the whole general public, but the general public, you're interested in education and things like that. I want them to be able to read it and to feel it's an interesting book and it's not too sort of geeky in a sense. But on the other hand, I want to appeal to policymakers who, you know, specialist educational policymakers. And I don't want them to be able to say, you know, this is very slight. This guy has just gone and sort of drifted over the surface. So I've wanted to put a fair amount of hard detail in because we figured it out. And in my view, beyond anybody else I found, but I want it to be readable. And I want to add some anecdotes to sort of lighten it up. And I also want to talk about the change politically that we need. So the idea is this book to appeal to everyone from, you know, parents interested in their kids' education, to teachers, to absolutely the university sector, to employers who are worried about, you know, the AI age and how they need to get their workers up to speed for that and their managers and things, and absolutely policymakers to figure out how our future math education and core computational education should look.
Yeah, and I will say what I appreciate about it is, you know, I've been in a community that's been thinking about these kinds of issues for years and years, but I found myself, you know, really having a dialogue in my mind about, you know, as I was reading the book. But it also, I think, is written in a way that a parent could read it if they're sort of curious about where is math education going? Where should it be going? And I think even policymakers who are not from education scholarship, I would hope that they could also sort of follow the thread of the lines of reasoning. So let's get a little bit more into that sort of central argument. I happened to write an article myself with Corey Webble, my colleague here, and we wrote an article about teaching in a world with photomath. Like, photomath came on the scene and there was a lot of people freaking out. Like, photomath is doing the math for the kids, you know, like the high school students. And Corey and I wanted to just sort of write that, don't freak out about photomath. Don't view photomath as a threat to math education. View it as a chance for the computer to do the computing, and it frees up the students and the teachers and the human beings to do the thinking and the conceptualizing and the connecting and all of the sort of higher level sort of human elements of it. So that was what we were trying to say, is use it as an opportunity to re-emphasize the more important, the more interesting kinds of aspects. So in my words, that's kind of my like nutshell of the thesis. I'm curious about, in your words, what would you say is kind of the nutshell of the thesis that you're sort of arguing?
I think that's a great description, actually, but a few different ways, which are not fundamentally different to that at all. I think we need to let humans step up to the next level, and we should let machines do what they're good at, and we shouldn't try and get humans to compete with what machines do best. Mm-hmm. So as you correctly say, you know, the computers, I mean, it even gives you a hint in the name, right? They compute stuff and they're awfully good at it these days, much better than any humans at that task by itself. But it's a funny mixture here, because the reason in the real world that mathematics is so used in the form of computation today, as opposed to 50 or 100 years ago, is because it can be used in many different domains. The reason it can be used in so many different domains is because we have mechanized calculations, mechanized computing. That's what's allowed mathematics not only to work for bits of physics and accounting, but to work for biology and mass data science and social sciences and all the rest of it. So it's kind of like, if you strip computers out in education, you will strip out almost all the context, and you will strip out many of the most interesting conceptual problems out of the mathematics, and most of the meaning from it, in the sense of what you can do with it afterwards. And so it's absolutely critical that we mimic the real world in education in terms of the subject matter, not just how we teach it, but the subject matter. Another way to say this is, we want first-rate human problem solvers, not third-rate human computers. And by allowing computers to do the mechanized bit of the four-step process, as we described, so the process we normally talk about here is, you know, define, abstract, compute, and interpret. I would describe that as the bare bones of, you know, the math process, the computational thinking process. And humans remain absolutely critical for steps 1, 2, and 4. Step 3, computers are typically better, and that's what we should let them do. Mm-hmm.
In the book, you have a section that's kind of called the fix, you know, after you've sort of laid out the problem, the disconnect that's sort of happening. But I want to dig into that fix section a little bit. So what do you see as a couple of the key ideas from the fix that you are proposing?
Well, firstly, as we talked about, assume computers at all time, right? So that means allow people to solve problems that are amenable if they assume computers are there. Don't strip out problems that aren't amenable if a computer isn't there.
I remember when I was a kid, adults would literally say, people are never going to all have a calculator in their pocket. And it's right. Like, that's exactly what we have now.
Right. And more than that, I mean, we have things that we have the whole cloud as well available and so forth. So you've got massive computing power at your disposal, what I sometimes call ubiquitous computation. So that's kind of, the baseline. I think there are some other things, though. We need to rewrite our outcomes. What is it we're trying to achieve from mathematics education, particularly compulsory school mathematics education? That, we have to remember, the world's population is forced to do this. It's not an optional subject. So we better be on track for why most people need it. And we need to be very clear what those outcomes are. So one of the things we've done is to make an outcomes tree to try and describe at a high level some of those. And things like confidence to tackle new problems, things like how to manage computations, as well as the details of, when you use a particular algorithm or a different algorithm, but also understanding things at many different levels. So, for example, I don't know why we're not teaching machine learning to primary school children. Well, because we've confused complexity of calculation with complexity of concept. And we need to reorder the curriculum so that it's ordered by conceptual complexity, whatever the calculating complexity. So things that are easy to understand in essence, or at least at one level easy. I mean, machine learning is very easy to understand at one level. It's very hard if you're building neural nets. That's a totally different range. But it's easy at the understanding of, how might you use it? When might you use it? So we need to separate these things into different levels and understand when we can teach them based on their conceptual complexity. So that totally reorders the curriculum. It changes fundamentally what you teach when. It also changes how ordered it needs to be. So in some cases, you don't need to order it as precisely as you did with our today's curriculum. I also think most people will respond much better to a problem-led curriculum, by which I mean start with a problem you actually want to solve. And it might be an abstract problem in math, but for most people, it'll be a problem in their lives. It somehow relates to them. You might be able how to get their bike to go faster or, whether they should insure their laptop computer if they're maybe a bit older. Whatever the problem is. And then use the mathematics as a tool for solving the problem. Now, abstraction is a very important concept in mathematics. It's sort of central to why it's powerful. But let's not start most kids with the abstraction, solve a quadratic equation. And hope that somehow they get all excited by that. And then one day, if they're very lucky, they can link that to a practical problem. So I think go in total reverse, start with a problem, involve the math to solve it, make the problems really complex and rich. Don't try and strip out all the interesting complexity from the problems and don't make them clean. So those are some of the things I talk about in the book. And one of the key things actually on the outcomes is how you get, so to speak, what I call thinking outcomes. Let's really be clear about what we mean by thinking in this context.
So when you're talking about being welcoming and really leaning into complex and messy problems, I was thinking that some of the reasons people are nervous to do that is because the computations will then get very messy. And so this is how it all kind of goes together, is you're saying, embrace the messiness, let the computers sort of sift through some of that complexity, but you can still, the human, you can still keep your eye on what's the problem we're trying to solve. How are we interpreting it? How are we going forward?
Exactly. And here's the crucial thing. This is really dangerous, what we're doing at the moment. And we see it, in fact, in some of the pandemic modeling and so forth. So people are taught at school because they're taught from this it's actually very interesting because I had a teacher, in fact, I mentioned this in my book. I had a teacher at school, in fact, who was a friend of Alan Turing's, as it turns out. Hmm. He was an interesting character, as you might imagine. And on his wall, he had written, math is the art of avoiding calculation. And what he meant was, in the olden days, the whole of the edifice was set up to avoid calculating because that was expensive. It was, human capability expensive. No subject has been so changed as math by mechanization, right? Because now it's on its head. The calculating is very cheap and plentiful. So his edict is totally the wrong way around nowadays. The reason that's so dangerous is because when people go and, let's say, model things, the first thing they tend to do is chuck out much of the data. because there at school they were told, you know, go and fit a normal distribution to the data, because that's what you were told to do, because you didn't have, you know, you couldn't play with too much because you couldn't calculate it.
Right. It's easier to work with the normal distribution.
Indeed. And so then they do things so simplistically and they don't get good decisions. I mean, in the end, all of this calculating data science is to produce better decisions. That's why we're doing it. So in order to get good decisions and nuanced decisions and decisions in all sorts of different areas of complexity, you need to have as much data coming in as possible. And you need to then be able to apply computation at the best level for that. So the modern current education tends to really teach you the opposite. You know, take one tool that you know very well and just apply that. Don't look at the other tools. And the complexity of modern life is you've got many, many different mathematical tools to apply. Which one is best? So all of these things we need to get our students to get experience at from the get-go. And part of the conceptual experience they need to gain is which tools, how to handle complexity when it all, you know, which complexity you can handle, what to do to understand the results without understanding how the tools work, none of which is available in today's curriculum. And that's why I, in the book, really say it's an urgent problem. And certainly for the mass population, if we don't have computational literacy where these sorts of understandings are embedded, we get very bad decisions across society.
So imagine that, you know, the education field broadly is trying to move forward on these ideas that you've talked about, others have talked about, you know, there's more and more calls for this sort of move in math education. But if we were moving in that direction, are there some caveats or some warnings that you would want to give to the community?
It's really tough to make subject change, particularly at school level education. Unfortunately, in virtually every country, the ecosystem of education has become pretty stuck. And particularly with respect to subject change. And you can see why, because exams lock down the subject. And in order to change the subject, you've therefore got to change the exam. But in order to change the exam, you've got to persuade all the schools and the teachers and the parents that that change is good. And you've got to persuade the universities that they should accept some different admission. And math is bang in the center of this because it's most quantitative in terms of the assessment. And people think it's absolutely the most critical subject. And so you can see why nothing changes very much. So one problem is to, in a sense, persevere. I believe that change will happen, but it's not going to happen easily or linearly. It's not necessarily going to happen. You know, it'll happen in one country first, which might be a small country. It won't necessarily happen in the US first or anything like that. But I also think you need to look for places to apply pressure for that change. So, for example, in many universities around the world, we hear exactly the same things. We've got A-grade students in math, you know, coming to our good university to read whatever subject, you know, engineering or science or maybe a less technical subject. And you know what? You sit them in front of their first problem that needs computation and they haven't got a clue what to do because the math they learned doesn't have a lot to do with the math we need. Although they might not call it math, they might call it data science. So I think early university is an interesting pressure point in a sense. Because obviously, if universities around the world decide, you know what, actually, there's a subject that we'd prefer people to have than the traditional math. We'd like a computer-based math subject. That will then drive changes. And different countries, these changes happen in very different ways. But fundamentally, that's a pressure point. I think another one, of course, is employers. You know, people already adults who haven't had this training and they need to become better employees, so to speak. And I think that's a very important place at which to look at. And it's not just coding. I mean, coding is important, but that's a particular skill. I think this is broader than coding. It's a way of thinking about life that's really important. People shouldn't get disheartened. This change will take time. They need to keep very focused on the idea it's the subject that needs to change. And don't get confused between applying computers to change, you know, to mimic what's in the real world with the subject and improving the pedagogical approach with computers. And there's lots of things we can do with computers to improve the pedagogical approach, but those are somewhat different aspects. Often when I hear people come at me, they say, hey, we're doing computer-based math. And I say, oh, that's great, wonderful, what are you doing? And they say, well, we're using a computer to help somebody learn how to solve an equation better by hand. I say, no, that's not computer-based math, that's helping pedagogy with a computer. And mm-hmm. Those two, I think it's important we don't confuse the computer-based and what I call that computer-assisted.
The way that I'm hearing you talk about it and in reading the book, to me, it's pretty clear you're not talking about ways of using apps or ways of using different devices as a teacher. You're talking about offloading that step three of the process, offloading that to the computers that are very good at it, and then really trying to flourish the other parts that are the human parts. So yeah, I think that distinction 100%. Is a good distinction. I'm speaking with Conrad Wolfram, who's also the founder of computerbasedmath.org. So that's a website I'll put in the show notes. I've got just two more questions for you, Conrad, and I really appreciate speaking with you. The first one is about the book. I'm just wondering if there were any surprises that kind of occurred to you during the process of writing it, like if you had any new kind of revelations or surprises, or maybe just in releasing the book, has anything kind of surprised you that you want to share?
One thing I thought about the book is, you know, we'd been writing about this for a long time and building curriculum and things, and I thought, it's great. I'll just take what I've done, put it together, sort of splice it together in a nice way, clean it up, and there I'll have a book. And I was wrong.
You couldn't just have computers do that for you?
Well, yeah, that would be even nicer. I could have saved a whole bunch of time there. I was wrong for several reasons. Firstly, the approach was wrong in terms of how it read and was. It just was getting into it too quickly and wasn't broadening it out. But much more important than that, there were interstitial pieces that we actually hadn't figured out. So it's funny, the old-fashioned write a book has actually helped us to plug some of the gaps, in a sense, in what we hadn't quite done. So that's been a very interesting to discover. And I think, therefore, I've now got a more rounded picture. I also decided in the book to include things that were not strictly about math. I think surprises in terms of its release. A lot of people have said, why have you just written it about math? This is the whole of education. This problem you're taught, these sorts of problems, I mean, not obviously the detail of the outcomes and things, but actually, even some of the outcomes, they're saying, you know, this applies to history as well. And, you know, so we're kind of disappointed you haven't broadened it out to that. And so to me, that's very interesting. I mean, what I said back is, I think the problem is worst in math by a long way, because I think that the subject has got much more disconnected from its real world uses. And it's also very central. There is a fantastically important subject out in the real world. It just isn't the one we're doing in school right now. And so that difference is much starker. And secondly, I not know much more about this than I know about, let's say, history. I mean, a very positive thing coming out from the book is, you know, I've tried to piece together things I really deeply know about subject matter and also make suggestions about my observations on pedagogical approaches and how you build curricula. People have been, they've been interested in many aspects of it. But the bits I thought was just I was kind of putting them in for completeness. They've said, oh, my goodness, you've got some things you've pieced together here that we hadn't really understood or thought about. And so I'm kind of pleased about that because, you know, I'm pleased that I've sort of added value in that aspect of it, too.
So I want to finish with kind of a fun question. And it's just to think about if you weren't in the field that you're in now and thinking about mathematics education reform and the work that you're doing with computer-based math, what could you imagine as an alternative career?
You know, I'm always interested in design of things. Hardware actually as much as software. So I suppose I could have imagined myself as, I don't know, a car designer or something like that. I mean, somebody who's interested in the form of things. And I'm very fussy about, you know, user interfaces and how things are. And I get very irritated when something's just slightly wrong. And so I could have seen myself doing something sort of semi-artistic design-wise like that, I suppose.
So this is just design thinking in general, but a pet peeve of mine recently is the card machines where now, you know, you put in your chip card, and I get frustrated with, seems like more than half of the chip cards, when it's in there, it says on the screen, do not remove card, which to me, it's like the majority of the letters on the screen are the words remove card.
Yes.
And so to me, I really prefer the ones, there's some of them that say, leave card inserted, which I'm like, thank you. Like now the letters that are there are actually reinforcing what you want me to do. So that's just a kind of design decision in terms of the
It's surprisingly
display.
Difficult to get these things right, actually. And I know because I involve myself quite a lot when we build our software with literally, you know, I'm a user. Let me understand whether I can understand what's happening here and can we optimize that? And it's funny, it's hard for, it's kind of an abstraction problem, actually. Can you understand backwards what somebody might think? And if you're this sort of person or that sort of person? And it's an interesting problem set. And there's something I find, I mean, one of the problems I have is I'm not very good at buying things nowadays because there's so much choice. And I always want to optimize because I know when I bought something that I really like, I really, really like it. And it makes me very happy. And when I buy something that's not quite what I want, even if it's a not very expensive thing, it really bugs me. And so that sort of is a funny optimization problem I find I have.
Mm-hmm. I've been speaking with Conrad Wolfram. The book is The Maths Fix, an Education Blueprint for the AI Age. Conrad, thanks so much for spending some time with me across this time difference.
It's great to talk to you, and I really enjoyed the questions.
I've written a children's book, and even though it's not a math book, I still think it's something that listeners of this podcast will enjoy. The book is called Missing Letters, an Alphabet Book. And it's a different sort of alphabet book. Instead of going through the alphabet and having words that start with each letter, Missing Letters shows what can happen if each letter is removed. So it's basically a word game where you start with a word, remove a letter, and then see what happens. The letters are emphasized through their absence. And young preschoolers can really hear the difference, while elementary kids can compare the changes in spelling. The illustrations by Leon Thomas emphasize the humor or the drama or sometimes the absurdity of the transformed words. And this missing letter word game encourages kids to play with language. Even beyond the book, you can come up with your own word pairs. I'm really excited for the book. I recommend it for kids aged 2 to 7 or for teachers pre-K to first grade. Again, it's called Missing Letters, an Alphabet Book. You can see excerpts and find out how to order it at missinglettersbook.com. That's missinglettersbook.com.